License and registration, please.
Come on, man. This is a desolate, waterless, post-apocalyptic landscape in which the most basic codes of society have broken down and the rule of law has been replaced by, you know, speed and violence. Nobody carries paperwork anymore.
License and registration, please.
Have you looked around you? It's all freaks and warlords in muscle cars. It's a reversion to petro-feudalism that... Never mind. Here they are.
So you are this Imperator Furiosa...
Yep.
But this 18-wheeler hot rod is registered to a Mr. Immorten Joe.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Can we speed this up? I'm in a hurry.
I noticed. Do you know how fast you were going?
As fast as I could. Did you see the people chasing me?
And you were shooting guns out of both windows. That's distracted driving. We're in the middle of a big initiative. Hands-free is not risk-free.
Oh, shut up.
You drive, you text... You pay.
I wasn't texting, I was shooting.
It's the same thing.
Look, just give me the ticket, all right?
I can make it a warning on failure to obey the posted limit. Because the only thing posted are human skulls.
Do whatever you want. Can I borrow your gun for a second?
Oh, sure. Here.
That was some kind of blood-seeking mutant. Look, this might take a while. Today, the nose tackles Mad Max Fury Road. And now he stars in a spin-off, Neurotic Morty. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, for some people, including, it turns out, Carolyn Payne, Mad Max is just too, it's too much. But Neurotic Morty, things go a little slower. I think you'll enjoy it more. So we are going to be talking about Mad Max Fury Road and sort of, I think, sort of letting some tentacles kind of spill out from there into kind of into other topics or other areas of ageism and sexism and patriarchy and stuff. All the stuff we like to talk about on the nose. Tanisha Duguid is with us. She's with Heartbeat Ensemble, but she's also a millennial hyphenate, she says, a freelancing actor, producer, writer, bon vivant. Carolyn Payne is with us. She invented millennial hyphenate. She's an actress, comedian, writer, dancer, Dance Impresario, and over the last 48 hours, music video badass performer, here with us a man really, you know, just no real hyphens. He's James Hanley. He is one of the founders of and leaders of Trinity Cine Studio. So, back in 1979, when the first Mad Max movie premiered, we had no name for a post-apocalyptic road film in which heavily armed hot rodders and bikers endlessly traded gunfire. Today, of course, we call it Texas. But George Miller, the man who invented it all, put the franchise on ice for 30 years while he made Happy Feet and Babe. And now he's back with a fourth installment, minus Mel Gibson and plus many, many ladies, including the granddaughter of Elvis Presley and the daughter of Lenny Kravitz and Lisa Bonet. Because how are you going to perpetuate humanity without swimsuit models? But the movie also has a lot to say, even though hardly anybody says anything. And I mean, the table read probably took less than 5 minutes. There's not a lot of dialogue here. But it has a lot to say about gender and age and heirloom seeds. A.O. Scott can stand in for a choir of rapturous critics when he says Mad Max Fury Road, like its namesake, is both humble and indomitable. It isn't about heroism in the conventional superpowered sense. It's about revolution. So there's been just a gigantic chorus of critics really loving this movie. A few dissenters do, as there will be. And people are calling it a masterpiece. People are calling it a feminist masterpiece. People are calling it other kinds of masterpieces. So we're going to try to work through all of this. Well, James, is it a masterpiece? You get to decide.
Well, you know, I was just thinking just before this, thinking about when we first showed the original Mad Max, when it was a cult film, kind of an art film, you know, that we played at midnight, and it didn't play the major theaters until later on. It was a very different thing. This arrives in a very different form, and I don't know. I can't join in the great praise of it for the reasons many of the critics are saying. To me, it's an action movie that's trying to appease a lot of people. George Miller has a reputation, of course, that and there's content in the film. There is real content, and I think it's potentially actually very radical content, but it doesn't seem to really run with it. And it also, not coincidentally, sort of drowns it out in sheer constant turmoil and noise, and which is the sort of expectation of the franchise kind of thing. So I have a feeling it's a film that sort of succeeds, but in spite of itself, and it doesn't really have the kind of clarity that it could have had about the women in the movie, for example. I mean, I think there are very mixed messages about the women in the movie that you know, we can get into that, the complexity of that. But it seems that, you know, the committee of investors all wanted their sort of insurance that, okay, this wasn't going to turn off the boy destruction crowd. It was also going to maybe hold on to their girlfriends, and maybe we'll get the lesbians too. And, you know, it sort of has this kind of like calculated quality about it.
Oh, maybe we'll get the lesbians too. I've been at those meetings so many times. So, Tanisha, I'm just going to let you guys kind of react to each other a little bit rather than try to orchestrate this conversation. Tanisha,
I guess, you know, the thing that is interesting to me on your point about sort of trying to please a lot of different stakeholders is that I didn't realize, like, the artistic team behind it until I watched the credits roll. And I think part of the sort of confused messaging when it comes to the feminist agenda in this film is that it is all produced and created by men.
Yes.
And there didn't seem to be, with the exception of maybe Charlize.
Eve Ensler was an advisor on
Craig.
It.
Craig!
Eve Ensler in here.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was a desperate
grab. That's what it was.
But
no, I think that's exactly what it was because I think they sort of probably realized maybe during the table read as they're reading all of this action, like, looking around this table.
Where are the ladies?
Yeah, and Charlize is like, well, as the one woman here with a voice.
So they went for the ultimate in feminism.
Well, there's also another thing that's kind of important about the end of the movie is that if, you know, I'm the only person in the theater, right, still watching the credits right through to the end. Everybody else has left. But even the names of the characters that come on at the end of the movie, most people miss that. Mm-hmm. They've gone by the time that comes on.
I honestly didn't even catch names of some of the main characters. I had them super confused. I left this movie with a headache. I felt like I had been at a metal rock concert and got hit by a bus and several of those vehicles that ran through there. I think it's so brave that you saw it in 3D, Tanisha. I could not have. It was just awful enough in 2D for me to experience this kind of chaos.
It does make me wonder, though, like, I've heard inklings of what kind of music they play during war. And I have to say, the dude on the electric guitar, the
flaming electric guitar,
I was like, that and the timpanis, like, that's the way, if I'm going to war, I'd like to go.
We should say that, and actually, right before the show started, Greg Hill, our tweetmaster, said, should I be warning people about spoilers? Mm. And I feel like there are... It's not that kind of movie, really. I don't think it really. It's not like Sixth Sense or something. You know, there isn't some big reveal at some point. But so, anyway, just to sort of explain, as the forces of chaos and evil roar into battle, one of the things they do have is a guy playing an electric guitar, kind of on the front of some big semi or something like that. And I mean, they're just, you know, it takes all of the gothic qualities of. I mean, I think one thing about the Mad Max movies is the first one was this very low budget, you know, late night art film. And then The Road Warrior came along and it sort of kicked up the production values quite a bit and kind of went into a different place. And it really, I do think that that's still a pretty good movie. And a sort of, you know, and Mel Gibson sort of embodying this kind of Gary Cooper type loner. And you know, one thing that George Miller seems to do very well is see into the future. I mean, this is sort of like a Peak Oil type movie that was made in the early 1980s. I remember, to Carolyn's point, getting in my car, and it kind of happened to me again this time, getting into my car in 1982 or whatever year that was, right after seeing The Road Warrior. It was still broad daylight, and I think I saw it up the now defunct East Hartford multiplex. And I just started, like, driving over curbs and stuff like that. I just had – I mean, not without really doing that consciously. I just had inherited this idea that, you know, you really shouldn't do anything except drive in a straight line no matter what's in front of you. And so I just broke, like, 8 different traffic laws and almost knocked over a stop sign in the first 60 seconds of operating my car. And I kind of felt that way this time, too.
Maybe that's why I've been driving the way I've been driving the past 48 hours.
It's interesting about The Road Warrior because The Road Warrior came at a time really when this whole idea of a movie being a product was just starting to develop. And this The Road Warrior itself was very influential in terms of, you know, like taking on that kind of action movie that was chaotic, you know, and had all of these things like, and it was transgressive, the idea of, you know, like you could you could do these things, and it had a sort of vaguely threatening quality, but it didn't have the kind of calculated quality that movies have now, movies of that kind. And I think this is a product of that kind of calculating quality of investors and returns and stuff like that. But there are all kinds of themes that are there that actually you can sort of tease out of it. Like, I think there's a really fascinating thing in Australia about the fact that Australia has been celebrating the sort of nobility of Gallipoli and the Australian soldiers at Gallipoli and sort of the general lie of war and the nobility of war and fighting the good fight and all the rest of it. And then along comes this movie, which is the idea of the rock guitarist on the front of this vehicle, you know, coursing through this hideous landscape. It's Australia's worst nightmare of its world image.
Well, and there are these one of the big sort of by the way, if you want to chime in, if you've seen the movie or you're for some interesting reason refusing to see the movie, 860-275-7266. Do not call in with uninteresting reasons for refusing to see the movie. 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at WNPR Colin. One of the things that's in this movie, there is this incredible multitude of these things called war boys, which are these pale and powdered, slightly mutant looking, sunken eyed they seem more like boys than like men, and one of the things, then they believe in this real Valhalla mythology that if they die in the glory of battle, great things are going to happen to them. And then one of these bizarre George Miller gothic touches is if they think that's about to happen, yeah, they always have at hand a can of silver spray paint which they spray around their mouths, which I don't think was done in Gallipoli, but we need to sort of dig into that feminist question. So a couple of things have happened. Some people have really kind of embraced this as kind of an interesting feminist progression argument. Charlize Theron's character is just indisputably a much bigger character than the title character in this movie. And then there are other female characters whose actual value as feminist icons we can probably debate here. So some people really embraced it, and then there turns out to be something called the Manosphere. Did you know there was something called the Manosphere?
I learned that in reading up about this movie.
In the Manosphere.
Are you a part of the Manosphere? Yeah.
We're standing at the edges of the Gynosphere, waving to you. But in the Manosphere, they're just not at all happy about this, and they feel like the whole thing has been sort of hijacked in a very unfortunate way. And I don't know. I mean, they're probably just kind of a little weird, freaky sideshow. But I don't know. Carolyn, does this film make a feminist statement? Is it plausibly some kind of feminist masterpiece?
I kept hearing about these. I was reading online before we saw the movie. I was getting kind of excited to see it just because there was this Manosphere and everyone saying, you know, oh my gosh, it's this raging feminist, the feminist film of this time. And it was, you know, men were mad about it. And so when I was going into the movie, I thought that Mad Max was going to be this like sad little man who was, you know, shaking in a corner while Charlize Theron's character is just like kicking ass and, you know.
That's neurotic Morty that you're thinking of. That's
right, yeah. So I'm there now. But I thought that's what I was going to be seeing. But it just wasn't the case. She is a strong female character, but he is a strong male character, and they're equals. So I didn't see it as some great, you know, feminist propaganda that is out there. I think there have been other action female heroes that can be celebrated more than this character.
It's interesting. I brought up on a time I was on the nose before this campaign called He for She. And that really came up for me a lot in watching this movie because, like you said, they are equals. I mean, he speaks far less, and that's not saying much in this movie.
Men speak less than women anyway.
This is all maybe that was the point he was making.
Maybe.
But I think but I do think that this sort of teamwork between the sexes was an important message, and him allowing her to sort of take the gun, so to speak, and literally.
I think that's very important in the movie, actually. I think that's something that comes through in spite of all the noise and mayhem and all of the sort of confusing stuff. That is a remarkable thing. And there's another remarkable aspect of Charlize Theron's character is that she's an amputee, and mm-hmm. there's no attention paid to that. It's just sort of there that she is
and
actually.
And I liked that.
I did too.
I love
because
that. My personal history, yeah. I was like, yes, that is
exactly
the kind of image I want to see.
I thought one of the best moments is when she goes to shoot the gun and she uses his shoulder.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that
she, after he misses.
Right. After he misses twice, she's like, let me handle this.
And Tom Hardy is a kind of like he's a different kind of person, really, for this film in that he gets that. He mm-hmm. gets that cooperation. He gets that what's going on there. And the dynamic that if there's anything that came out of the movie that really riveted me at times was the interplay between them.
There's something mm-hmm. about when she goes to the Vuvellini.
Yeah.
Vuvellini.
I can't wait to get to the Vuvellini.
Sorry. But they're this gang of older, if that's the PC way of talking about these women, this gang of amazing older women who raised her, basically. And she brings this man and they go, who is he? What is he? And what she says to them, still I think about. She goes, he's reliable.
Yes.
And I thought, oh my God, like that shouldn't feel revolutionary, yeah. But that
right.
as
yes.
the
yeah.
thing that totally. Is the best feature of this man is that he's reliable
yeah.
spoke so
yeah.
much to me.
Right. I think you're right.
I mean, I saw this movie as I did. I sort of saw the kind of as kind of mythic statement about women. It may be a very unsuccessful mythic statement about women, but I kind of saw it that way. And it maybe some of it may have to do with my chronological placement in a generation of people. There was a period of time, I think it probably was. It's all a blur now, but let's say it was in the 1980s when a whole bunch of women were reading this book called The Great Cosmic Mother, and everybody was sort of Wiccan curious, you know? Everybody was sort of looking at all this kind of imagery. And so you heard a lot about these three female archetypes that are prominent within Wiccan dialogues and stuff like that, the maiden, the mother, and the crone. And I saw that very much in this movie. I mean, first of all, there are no spoilers. So basically, the precious cargo in this movie, it was sort of supposedly oil or gasoline in the Road Warrior. And this time it is what are called breeders, which are these – and they really do – they're sort of absurdly hot women. One of them really is.
That was yeah. a serious problem.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
did they
problem.
Have to be wearing their nightgowns?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
it's like
– in battle.
The
yeah.
costuming was way
yeah.
off.
In all
there.
White when everybody else is
yeah.
brown.
That was like back to that investors conference.
Everyone
you know?
Was so
okay.
dirty and they were all pristine and showered with
right,
their hair
right.
done.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just
you
didn't
one
add
of them
up.
Like Daenerys Targaryen. Yeah. I was like, what is that about?
As the,
you
as
can
our,
have the amputee, but you're going to have the nightgowns too.
Exactly. As our friends over on Slate Culture Gabfest said, they discussed it this week. I think it was Dana Stevens who said, so, you know, there's this ragtag Les Miserables mob of humanity that's stuck back at this place called the Citadel where water is doled out in this very haphazard and unhappy way, and they're completely sick and miserable and dirty and undernourished. But the only people really worth saving are those Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. You know, those are the people who really have to be saved. But anyway, I think they are sort of – so the whole notion of them is that they are breeders. They are receptacles for the seed of this dreadful, horrible – he's sort of like if Darth Vader really let himself go and didn't have good medical care. You know, I mean, he's like worse than – he's good. You know when Darth Vader's helmet comes off and he's all kind of squishy and pale
yeah.
and stuff like that? That's like – Morta and Joe's whole body is sort of like that, and he's the most grotesque – thing imaginable, but somehow or other
and
they
breathing
have to,
problems too.
And breathing problems, and so but they have to absorb his seed somehow and perpetuate the human race. And so the whole idea is to get them out of this. And so the person trying to get them out of this is this kind of, I mean, she's not exactly a mother figure, but she is a mother figure to them, I think, and that's the Charlize Theron character. And then they go out into the desert, and there's this kind of, you know, sleeping gypsy type look to this, you know, beautiful but incredibly stark and barren desert where they come upon this group of women named the Vuvellini, and they are crones, you know. I got in trouble in my own house for saying that, but I mean it in a good way. That the notion within that whole Wiccan dialogue was that, you know, this is a different kind of power, right? It's the power of older women.
The wise women.
The wise women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who are wise warrior women in this case,
yes.
too. I
yeah.
mean, you know.
We get into our age thing. Where you go, yes. They carry
right.
carry the knowledge. They carry the seeds of the future. I mean,
right.
it's an important figure. And I think that's probably one another one of those sort of main features that made people go, yes, this is a feminist film.
Well,
because how often do you see that?
It's true. And that's what bothered me about the film, in the way that it didn't go anywhere with that. Mm-hmm. And that is really, I mean, it really is radical thinking to actually talk about the sort of the stored knowledge and the idea that these women would be the guides to something different. And the movie sort of almost gets there, but then dissolves into a very sort of conventional way of resolving it with yet more mayhem. And it's something that you sort of feel that maybe had this been made a few years ago, where it didn't have the pressure to be a major movie, in quotes, that maybe you could have done something with that. That's where my disappointment, I think,
and
came.
Maybe if they had more women on the creative
absolutely,
production side.
Absolutely.
Because
right.
I don't think
yes,
Eve Ensler
totally.
Can say, as a crone perhaps herself, right. that these women need more of a say
right.
in a script that's probably 10 pages.
Right. Yeah.
And
I think
it requires
if they
dialogue
extended,
to do
that. Yeah. I think if they would have incorporated some dialogue in this film, there's a lot they could have
yes,
done.
That's right. Yeah.
I think that that's where it fell short, yeah. that there weren't they didn't allow things to develop yeah. more.
Well, but I sense this thing in the air that mentorship, as important as it is a dangerous thing. The idea yeah, of passing yeah. ideas down from one generation to a next in a real tangible way, yeah. I get this feeling in the atmosphere that that's not what we want from our society.
When
which
I hear
is
the
a
word mentor,
thing.
I think of that Seinfeld episode where Jerry is dating the woman who has a mentor. She's the mentee, and then somehow he finds out that the mentor is dating Kenny Banya, his stand-up comic nemesis, who is just awful. So the word mentor just. For some reason, that episode is always what pops into my mind whenever someone talks about mentoring. I think of that, and I think that there is this part of people that, like, you know, if somebody's like, "Oh, I'm going to mentor you," it's there's
well,
something.
Isn't that the essence of how the term mentor has been sort of commodified like
exactly.
that and turned into something different? If you think about things like in ancient societies of storytelling, for example, of a griot in Africa or any kind of opportunity where an older person can tell stories to children or to young people and actually see that as an important part of their education, just as important as other aspects. And then these characters, whatever they are called, these older people in the society, and in particular the older women characters in Mad Max, in Fury Road, they could have been very significant in getting that across as not that commodity,
exactly.
not that sort of cheap
exactly.
you
yeah.
know, mentor, the idea of mentor, that this could actually be something that actually benefits people. Mm-hmm. That people who are trying to learn how to do things actually can see that one of the particular things that could have been brought out in this movie is to be able to see the larger issue and not the immediate issue, which is a thing that young people have a great deal of difficulty seeing.
Go ahead.
I was going to say quickly, and the movie ends right before how you rebuild the world begins.
Yes.
Right. And that's when you need
right.
those women in those stories.
Exactly right.
We're going to continue this conversation, maybe even look at some ways in which there are sort of uncanny and eerie parallels out there in the real world. We'd love to hear from you, too. 860-275-7266. We'll take a break. We'll be back. All right. We're going to just keep having this conversation. There's a lot of different places we can go here. We're starting out with Mad Max Fury Road, but there we'll go many places from there. Hope you come with us. Our number is 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I do think in this movie, just to sort of – I want to stick up for the crones just a little bit more and say – or the Vuvolini or whatever we're going to call them. I mean, I think they're really important in this movie too because, you know, quite frequently in movies when – if you're looking at that sort of third stage of womanhood, it's like Blythe Danner or something, you know. Whereas, I mean, these women—they're leathery, they're wizened, and they're very tough. They're kick-ass. There's an implication. I mean, this movie implies so much more than it states, and I'm sort of okay with that. But there's an implication that well, they've lived their lives, and if they have to take a bullet to keep things going, you know, that's just kind of the way it's going to be. And the other thing that they're doing that's very interesting to me, and we were talking during the break about there's a lot of playing around with very elemental things, including breast milk. And we can either talk about that or not talk about that. But the other thing is seeds. You know, seeds are like this very big deal, you know, because there's nothing growing really, you know, and they're trying to grow some stuff and they lack that all important water thing. And
earth.
Yeah. And there's this kind of this sense anyway that that's a really big thing. It's odd because I just happened to catch the first couple of episodes last week of The Last Man on Earth, this Will Forte comedy that's on right now. And one of the things that goes on very early in the comedy is that Kristen Schaal, who turns out to be the last woman on Earth, she really wants to grow like heirloom tomatoes and stuff. That's really, really – I mean they live in a similarly kind of blasted landscape, except that everything's still sort of there. So you can go into Costco and get 84 cans of tomatoes. I mean you won't die for lack of tomatoes, but she really wants to grow heirloom tomatoes. She wants water piped down for it and everything. I think that is tapping into some of our kind of climate change anxieties, and I think that plays out in the movie too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you want to talk about breast milk? We could talk about breast milk.
No, I talk about breast milk all the time.
That's true. It's kind of a busman's holiday for you.
I do think it's one of those things, though, again, that you know, that the absence of women in central roles as scriptwriters and producers, and well, there are actually producers there are, but particularly scriptwriters, you know, could actually make the breast milk part that appears in this movie actually be something that means something rather than kind of a joke that, you know, ew, sort of, you know,
and
like
offensive.
And offensive.
I mean, exactly. The women who are right. The feeders are predominantly brown, Hispanic,
yes,
or black.
Exactly.
They're humongous. And yeah, something about that.
I felt
really uncomfortable.
Aren't we meant
there.
To be offended by that? I mean, to me, that was, you know, back to sort of to James's point about sort of Australian colonialism and stuff like that. I thought that was Miller maybe throwing stuff in their face, too. That's still, you know, that looked like sort of the conventional model of wet nurse.
And yet I feel like we're not there yet.
I think that could
that, like,
I
having
think,
that.
Yeah. I think that could be true if it had been worked out in the script and it had actually been part of the story, because in using them as devices, you could see that somebody like George Miller might well be throwing it in the face of Australian culture doing that. But you have to think of things like, for instance, the insertion of the thing about breast milk also comes in the context of women being harassed because they're actually feeding babies in public.
Right.
And, you know, the whole idea that somehow breast milk is icky, that could be made into a theme in a movie like that to do that is sort of like that kind of shoots in the foot the idea that you're actually making a serious comment about these big earth mother, you know, nurturers in the film. Yeah. And it's sort of muddled in that way. I think that doesn't come out clearly.
The whole film I just felt was muddled. Like it had all these concepts, like where it was trying to make so many different statements about so many different issues, whether it, you know, be Australian culture inherited, feminism, whatever they were trying to go for. It's like they get you almost there, but then not take you somewhere with it. So for me, I had to go home and I, you know, just researching and trying to put together and figure out how I felt about it and process it.
And that makes you think that probably most people are not going to do that when they see the movie. And so they're actually taking a different message away from the movie.
They're just
and that's
thinking,
what I
like,
meant by
those
we're
explosions
not there
were
yet.
Really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, is that we're not there yet, that I don't think we're ready for I don't think we
an
understand
action film that
irony.
Is also going into in-depth issues.
Right.
Well, I think we better be ready for it because, I mean, the other thing that fascinates me about this is that I did sort of send this around earlier this week. But, okay, so, you know, when the first Mad Max movies came out, they were about these marauding bands of bikers and highly motorized thugs who were racing around terrorizing people and ruling a landscape through force and speed and violence. And so that was in the 1980s these movies came out. Then in the 1990s, and I did an article about this, and I interviewed James for it. This is the thing that kills me. Around 1992, around the time the collapse of Somalia, so that you had the Saeed and Aidid factions and the sort of the mess that America got involved in a much more direct way after having supported various satellite factions and monkeyed around in the past with the polity of Somalia. So all the journalists were saying it looked like Mad Max. They all the TV journalists and the print journalists, they go to Somalia and say, well, it looks like Mad Max. It looks like the road war here. Looks like Mad Max. And James at the time said, isn't that the final insult to sort of, you know, after having been directly involved with causing this situation, then show up and go, wow, it looks like this movie we have back home. It's just, you know, and, but now, of course, it's not Somalia. It's here, right?
Exactly.
I mean, Mad Max is like right at our – well past our shores. Today there's a town in Texas that's calling for all kinds of help because they think that those two gangs – it's called Mingus, Texas. They think the Cossacks and whoever the other ones are going to show up and shoot there, you know? And I mean – it just isn't really very different, is it?
No.
And it has some of the same elements. I mean, the staff, the women who are the servers at Twin Peaks, the restaurant where the mayhem took place in Waco, they're very scantily dressed. It's like, you know, the whole
breeders.
The breeders, exactly.
The wives,
right.
As they
yeah.
say.
Yeah. It's very and the remarkable thing is here that you're talking about, like, this place where it took place is like a big shopping mall area. You know, all the big retailers are there, right? And then this is like a scene from a Mad Max type of setup is actually taking place in the midst of all of this, this sort of retail mecca.
Yeah, it's not like out in Texas, like on a desert that would look in your mind like Mad Max.
Exactly.
No, it's in a
and now, of course, the story is being told about how, oh, these weren't really marauding bikers. You know, we're getting these human stories about how, oh, they were, you know, they were titled veterans, you know, with medals and stuff like this. And so, okay, so what exactly happened here then?
I can't with all of that. All right. We know what those bikers look like, and so that's where that whole element comes from. I can't.
I want to grab a call here from Paul, our number 860-275-7266. Paul, checking in from Hartford. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
You're on the air.
I had a quick comment around the movie being feminist that was discussed earlier. I think the definition of feminism that I grew up with was equality between the genders. So I think in that basic definition, I thought the movie was feminist and depicted that really strong male and female characters very well.
I have a question about that. It's not a comment. It's a question. And this came up for me when the movie Thelma and Louise came out. And it certainly was looked at kind of that way, right? And I sort of thought, well, is that feminism and is that equality? I mean, they're kind of out of control and they're going to die at the end. And it's just, you know, they're sort of jerks the way male action heroes are often jerks. I mean, is that really equality? Is that – I mean, I like the equality in this movie probably a little bit better than I like that. But it does raise the question, like, what is equality? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody want that one?
Well, I think that when you get into that situation, you have to look at what are the characters in the movie and what is their real sort of reason for being there. And this goes back to the thing that I felt about the old women at the end of the movie, which was such a provocative and radical idea as to what their role was and where they were going to go. It's like the scriptwriters didn't have an idea for that. And so it really petered out at the end and so didn't really address these issues of sort of equality in quotes. I mean, you can say – you could populate a movie evenly with male and female characters and actors and play it out. But if you don't have any ideas that actually say what's going on here, they're just really characters in a Mad Max Fury Road contains a lot of mayhem.
What one of the point were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, and it's kind of tough because I think about the end of the movie and the way in which it ends, and that could be perceived, I guess, as a feminist ending or a way of equal partnership and gender roles. But I also think about like you said, this sort of character breakdown,
yeah.
And Max is a lone wolf,
yeah.
And so it's not a decision, and I guess that's sort of where my brain goes, I don't know if we're talking about really equality because he wasn't saying, yeah. I cede this or I'm giving you this. This is sort of like, and I'm off to my, like, this is what I do as a Lone Ranger. I'm not making a
Well,
statement.
It goes to the heart of what equality really is.
Right.
Equality is actually having equal power.
Right.
And if you don't have equal power, you can be there, but you're not really, you're not expressing equality.
And I feel like
women,
if he stayed.
The wives like that's where the lack of a that's where it lost its like feminist right. edge for me.
Well, yeah. Carolyn, I thought one interesting point that you made in our many emails this week was that you know, almost lost in the shuffle of this long conversation that's been going on online and in various critical columns about feminist questions and feminist issues in Mad Max Fury Road is that Mad Max Fury Road was eclipsed at the box office by Pitch Perfect 2, which really is sort of the work, I think, of a woman auteur, Elizabeth Banks, and is. It manages to be, first of all, this incredible movie franchise, apparently, without having to traffic in any of the stuff that we're talking about right now.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to admit that I willingly saw Pitch Perfect 2 last weekend. I went to see Mad Max for this. Pitch Perfect 2, I think, I don't think like that that's, you know, some great feminist opus either, even though it was written by a woman and it is the, you know, predominantly female characters.
And production team. The production
team.
Supervisor,
exactly.
All female.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. I will say that I do think if I was going to tell someone to go see a movie between these two, I'd say go see Pitch Perfect 2.
It's Akka amazing.
Akka amazing.
Pitch Perfect 2 will be watched in my house. It's like 17 times once it's available on video. Yeah, what were you going to say?
I think it's kind of interesting industry-wise, too, that, you know, that there aren't – at this time of year when the big tent poles are coming out and the big summer plans are being announced for what's coming next – that there are not many films that actually appeal to that audience, not just women, but I think men who appreciate a good story that's told by women. And that the nature of Pitch Perfect being a success like that and taking off, I think I see that as a really hopeful sign that it's a symbolic thing that, hey, it knocked into number one position. And it's an indication that a lot of people did go to see it. I mean, the money was very good. It wasn't just that, you know, often in the industry when a film like that comes along, somebody in the industry will say, oh, well, you know, the rest of the all the other movies were dying, and so this one bubbled to the top.
Right.
But they can't say that about this, and this is different.
Yeah,
I
hate going to the movies. It's actually one of my least favorite activities. I have several fears involving going to the movies, including like, oh, my gosh, what happens if I have to go to the bathroom and I miss the most important part? or you know, all sorts of weird movie phobias that I deal with. But again, that being said, I saw the previews for Pitch Perfect 2. I liked the first one. And I was like, you know what? I really want to see that movie this weekend.
I mean, it made the money. And so that is awesome for female producers and female directors. It is cute beyond belief. And I have a really – that's where I get sort of like tight in my chest about it. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like this idea that women can do well making cute movies is – can be difficult when you want to tell a story. That is, and not that Pitch Perfect doesn't tell a story. I loved the first one too, and I'll wait for it to come out on DVD or on demand to see the next one. But it worries me because I know that we, as an industry, we get into this place where we go, okay, well, that formula worked for a group of women, and therefore every female-driven film must be cute in this way.
No, but that's the thing with Mad Max. It could have been
called Furiosa.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
But
I think that was James at the James's imaginary meeting. That was rejected instantly. You know, just to your point about Pitch Perfect, and I think you were the one who pointed this out as we were emailing back and forth, that, you know, as self-actualizing as Pitch Perfect is, Rebel Wilson apparently still has to lie about her age. She's been telling people she's 29 and so she got caught out being 35, right?
Which I don't know how she thought she could get away with that in this
because
day.
Everybody does.
I mean, I get it. Like, if somebody asks me how old I am, I'm probably going to lie. Yeah, totally, 22. And then Maggie Gyllenhaal, it just came out yesterday that she is 37 and was told she's too old to play opposite a 55-year-old man to play his love interest. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can. It's
but really... Charlize Theron is she is, you know, nearly 40. I mean, she could be older than that, as you pointed out. She's. You know, she's still strong enough to go and, you know, wield weapons and be real strong.
But that's different.
She can't
than
be a love interest.
That's exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
That's different. She's no longer, to refer to that Amy Schumer video, she's no longer blankable, right?
Right.
She's bankable maybe, but she's not blankable.
And she's an archetype in the way that she's portrayed in those parts. And I saw a very interesting contrast in the movie we're showing at Cine Studio, The Clouds of Sils Maria. Juliette Binoche is an actress who's, you know, throughout her career, she's been aging on screen. And her parts reveal that she is clearly happy in her skin. I mean, I think that Charlize Theron is a person who could probably play some really interesting, serious roles. But she is now in a place, I think, where that kind of appearance that she has, sort of ageless appearance, if you like, in Mad Max, it's sort of like accommodating that ageism that exists in Hollywood and amongst agents, you know, about, you know, well, whether you can play this part because you're too old to play against this matinee idol or something like that.
And I think the distinction between Hollywood.
Well, so French women get a pass on this.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm going to say. I think there's a distinction between Hollywood and Paris. I mean, Meryl Streep is coming out with a film where she's playing a rock star. I think that is in opposition to Binoche and the way in which she has been able to age on screen.
I think that it's not we are getting
Hollywood
a lot
thing.
Better about the kind of roles, and I think women are creating them for themselves, like the Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda show on Netflix.
Well, both of them have money. That's why.
Exactly.
Well, they get to control
and they've been
the
around forever to use the mentor phrase again.
That is the key.
They're tried and true.
Yeah, exactly. And but the real issue is having the money to put in to actually control what happens. And then you can see the women hired as scriptwriters, for example.
And no disrespect to Netflix, but Netflix is the place like HBO and Showtime used to be where those kinds of projects can get made. This isn't CBS. This isn't one of the big four.
Exactly, but we're getting there.
I do want to say sort of the final frontier. I don't think we really have a lot of time left to discuss it. But even if we begin to solve some of these problems on screen, the final frontier turns out to be merchandise. Deborah Timms, one of our interns, pointed this out to me, that there's a huge controversy going on because as toys come out of the Avenger franchise, they actually take the scene that is played by Scarlett Johansson's character Black Widow and sort of remake the toys so that they are ridden or used by either Captain America or Iron Man. The theory being that even though that's like this really very peak scene in the movie, it's sort of, you know, it's a really great dramatic action moment with the Black Widow dropping down on her motorcycle, that little boys won't buy the action figures and little girls don't play with action figures. So there are now entire merch watch websites. There's a Tumblr called, I think, But Not the Black Widow, because the Black Widow also is the only Avenger who's not going to get her own solo
movie.
You
got to give a call out to Mark Ruffalo, who plays the Incredible Hulk, and he even said, he was like, I'm disappointed as, you know, an actor in the film who has a daughter that her voice wasn't represented in the toys. She plays with them.
I think that this problem has been going on for years, though. I remember when I was a kid and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out. Mm-hmm. Like, my brother, like, we had all the turtle action figures. We had the sewer. And I wanted an April O'Neil. She was so hard to find. I remember, like, my mom driving me to, like, Toys R Us, like, across Massachusetts to try to find April O'Neil. Because they must have made, like, one of those for every, you know, 700 Michelangelos they made.
Well, I can tell you, I can tell you the meeting where they do the merchandise. I can tell you who was sitting at the table, you know. It's like, these are people who are really calculating what they see as the dollars. And they see that, okay, well, male action figures, people buying for boys spend more money on these action figures, and so therefore they're going to do that. And they decide it. I mean, the Walmart people at the table are who decide what happens with that, not the actors or the producers or the artists or the writers or the people who, you know, are outraged at the image of the story being changed. But it seems extraordinary to me that what are they doing to their fans in the sense that, you know, people who've seen the movie and watched the movie and then aren't people going to see that this is not?
People are seeing. We're going to have to take a break here. I should say, being pulled off the shelves, even as we speak, are the Josh Duggar action figures. The action figures will not be popular anymore. All right. We've got to take a break.
I had to go see the Mad Max movie twice. I missed the Sheryl Sandberg cameo the first time. Lean in, baby. Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Jules Lefevre, Alex Dubin, Deborah Timms, and Kelsey Bissell. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Tina Turner. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff making waterless, flourless, gasoline-flavored chocolate cake, visit our website, wnpr.org/Colin. Enjoy your holiday weekend. We'll be back Tuesday with an in-depth interview with Hartford stage director Darko Treznik. And now, back to Colin.
And it's time for endorsements. Actually, my endorsement is going to have something to do with that, but we'll come to that in just a second. So, Carolyn, what would you like to endorse?
I will endorse the CT Improv Stand-Up Spectacular, which is tomorrow night at the Carrot House, and I am doing a set at that. So everyone should come, and it'll be fun.
Well, could we also, while we're doing this, endorse the fact that the CT Improv Kickstarter ends on Tuesday? And that's
about to go there.
Oh, you're going to go there? Oh, then go there.
No, you go ahead. You're reading it, so you'll probably get all that information out a lot clearer.
Well, actually, I just sort of read everything that I just had. But anyway, if you go to ctimprov.com theater, well, I mean, the notion of this is to actually have a comedy theater in Hartford, an actual dedicated CT Improv comedy theater. And really, when I make a mental list of like the 10 things that I think could break in the right way for Hartford, you know, in the next 3 to 4 years, that's on that list. I think that would be really kind of an amazing thing. So go find their Kickstarter or just go on their website and it'll show you how to help them build their theater. All right. Was that it?
That was it.
That was your full endorsement. All right, here we go.
I have a couple of movie things. The Tales of Hoffman is showing at Cine Studio next week, which is an amazing Technicolor restoration. And also May 29th through June 6th, the 28th LGBT Film Festival at Sony Studio with an incredible array of films. They're really good. If you go on the website for outfilmct.org, you can find out all about them. And also, our friends are going on the Tour de Cure, which is the diabetes ride, at June 14th at Durham Fairgrounds. You can go on diabetes.org to find out about it. It's a really great event and for a great cause, the Tour de Cure on June 14th.
All right. Tanisha.
Yes. So I'm going to continue with my sort of family fun endorsements. That's going to be my theme for the summer. And so the first one is, my brain went blank. The Heirloom Festival in Wethersfield. We start out there. That's on Sunday from 10 to 5. It seems like and the weather's going to be gorgeous, so come check that out. Heirloom Seeds, if you're into that. You want to make your own heirloom tomatoes, go check that out. And New York Pickle Deli. Mm. Great place in Rocky Hill on Shunpike Road. Awesome, awesome. So adorable. It's been around for 30 years. It's family owned. Went there this morning with my family and it was awesome.
All right. And once you get those heirloom seeds, of course, you have to race with them across the desert to find someplace that they can grow. All right. So as Kion was just mentioning, on Tuesday we're going to run an interview with Darko Trejnik. And I am going to, in that interview, and I know this because I've already done it, taped it, gush quite a bit about Kiss Me, Kate, and I will gush right now, too, at the Hartford Stage Company. I mean, first of all, I really do feel – I mean, I'm kind of a groupie, you know. I mean, I really do feel like we're very lucky to have this guy here working and I hope that that continues. But while we've got him here anyway, this is a kind of a really remarkable staging of Kiss Me, Kate. And it's a musical whose powers and whose great songs I'd kind of forgotten. I went in there sort of thinking, well, there aren't any really, you know, sing around the piano songs or anything like that. But I just was – and then I didn't look at the programs because I wanted to be surprised as each song came up. Really just amazing songs. And then just his thinking out of this thing. I mean, they're just – I just have never gone to anything that he's directed where I haven't thought – wow, you know, he just sort of, you know, in terms of getting sort of a visual idea up there on stage, it just was it is absolutely amazing. It only runs through, I think, June 14th. You don't have a lot of time. I think there really almost is no excuse for any empty seats while it is running here. I've got a couple of extra seconds here, so I will mention also the – I've mentioned this before, but – you know, a really terrific series came to its season finale this week. And I'm not talking about Mad Men. I'm talking about it – or last week. I'm talking about American Crime. American Crime is a really good series which has amazing performances. And I think you could probably binge watch it somehow now, either on demand or – there must be some way to do it. And if not, wait until there is. But it really is a remarkable series about race and criminal justice. And it has some of the most incredible performances by Felicity Huffman, by Timothy Hutton, but also by a whole series of actors
Regina
that you've never
– hmm?
Regina King. She's so – I love Regina King anyway. She's so great in it. I just found out that the guy who plays the Mexican kind of – sort of thug was in fact recruited by one of those programs that tries to sort of repurpose or divert gang members. And he's actually been in a lot of movies and done a lot of TV, but he sort of comes out of that background. He wears his gang qualities quite honestly. So really, I mean, go back and it's a really – it's the series ending is kind of interesting. It's a little bit – like all series endings, I guess, these days, a little bit inconclusive intentionally, but also really, really interesting. So I do recommend that too. All right. And yeah, don't forget that CT Kickstarter program. It'd be so great to have a comedy theater here. All right. We're going to say goodbye. We're going to thank Tanisha Dugan and James Hanley and Carolyn Payne. We'll be back on Tuesday.
Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah. You on the radio, you on the radio.
On the radio, baby.
You and me talking about it now.
The one thing I learned from watching Mad Max was to definitely always carry heavy-duty chain cutters in my car. Oh, and a double-neck electric guitar. And war paint. And maybe some Kleenex.